ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
This is Attention Plus with Arnab Ray, episode 102, recorded on the 4th of October 2020, India time. I am Vikram Mohan. And today Arnab talks about IPL, Trump getting COVID, and the Hathras and Balrampur incidents. So let's quickly get your host in and get started. Hey Arnab.
Hello Vikram.
Arnab, since you're starting with IPL, let me ask you, I mean, four matches in for each team. And we've got, I think, DC. I still think Deccan Chargers each time I see DC. Am I the only one? DC, then...
No, because you're from Hyderabad. That's the problem.
Probably. Then, of course, you've got Bangalore, Mumbai Indians. I think, SRH is probably number four right now. So, is this an indicator of the future of the tournament or is it too early to tell?
It's too early to tell. It's been a fairly even tournament. I think, when we last made the prediction, I don't recollect who were exactly in my top four, but I had Delhi Capitals.
You had KKR. DC, yeah.
I had Delhi Capitals, I had KKR. I had put Mumbai Indians after Raina had withdrawn and Harbhajan had withdrawn. Initially, my CSK was part of it. But then, you know, Raina is a huge difference and you can see the difference that he makes to the team. So, I brought him out. There was definite that SRH wouldn't be in the top four. I don't recollect and you can see that SRH has severe problems. Now, the last game, they did have some contributions from Priyam Garg, but unless there is some contribution from anybody outside the top three, they're going to find it difficult to consistently win matches.
And is there any news on Bhuvi's fitness?
I don't know. I don't think he's playing tomorrow. That's what I heard.
So, today. Oh, yeah. For yeah,
today.
Right.
Tomorrow.
Yes.
So, IPL, I don't recollect who I put in my top four. I don't know if I put Bangalore in my top four.
You didn't have Bangalore, if I remember. I mean, that's the only difference. Of course, you had Kolkata. I believe, did you put in Punjab?
I think I put in Punjab.
And they are doing well. I mean, they just had some bad luck, but incredibly close games. The team has been doing well. It's just a matter of time.
Yes. So they have been doing very well. And again, the reason why I felt good about them was because I felt this tournament would be KL Rahul's tournament. And he's proven me right in that respect. So I participate in this draft, a fantasy league with some friends. Which is run by, you know, another friend of mine. They're kind of creating an app and startups. Uh-huh. So there, when we had the draft, I was second in the draft. So the first person I chose was KL Rahul. Because I was that confident that this year would be KL Rahul's breakout year. So first of all, I would say that the IPL so far has been very good in terms of the quality of games, in terms of the pitches, which was quite surprising. In general, I think that of the pitches, the weakest pitch I would say is the Sharjah one. I think it's just too loaded in favor of batsmen. When you need to score essentially 220 to win, it's 220 is a par score on the ground. I think that's a little bit extreme. 220 should not be par score anywhere in 20 overs. So I think that Sharjah. And this is compounded by two things. One, the pitch is just a steady bounce, flat track beauty, and the boundaries are scandalously short. So I think that the Dubai pitch is possibly the most fair in terms of all the other pitches. I think that's the best pitch.
Right.
And I mean, honestly, I feel that 160, 170 pitches are, you know, games are usually the best because there is at least some semblance of there's some semblance of cricket. Otherwise, it has, like, what's going on in Sharjah now, it's essentially stick cricket. That's really what it is. For those of you who have played stick cricket, you know what I mean. I mean, it's a game in which, have you ever played stick cricket, Vikram Mohan?
Oh, big fan.
Yeah, so if you miss one ball, it's the end of the game. If you don't hit it for six. So every ball has to be hit for a six, essentially, in stick cricket. So this is... And the other interesting thing is that one thing that I didn't perhaps factor in when I was doing my pre-IPL analysis was how hot it was, how hot it is going to be,
right?
And how that heat is going to affect, let's just say, the more mature players in the side. And you can just see that three people who are three, you know, let's look at all the old guard and see how they're doing. Dhoni has been a disaster. Or the only thing that's good about Dhoni's performance is it's better than Karthik's. And Shikhar Dhawan has found it difficult to fire. Robin Uthappa is a meme now. So again, these are all very, very good players. It's not that they're, but their time is up. And you can see that what is actually being exposed is their, you know, universally their lack of, I wouldn't use the word fitness. It's not that they're not fit, but in conditions, in extreme conditions like this, when they're competing against people who are, you know, 10 years their junior minimum, some even, I mean, a PMGAG is like 19, almost like half their age. It just becomes very difficult to maintain that level of intensity. I mean, I don't know if you saw the last game with Chennai Super Kings. I mean, Dhoni at the end.
That was the Deccan Chargers match, right? Sorry, I keep saying Deccan Chargers. That was a Sunrisers match.
Yes, he just felt that he was just close to collapsing almost in that game. And, you know, how many overs did he bat? He doesn't bat for long. I mean, he batted a little bit longer in that game.
He also kept for 20 overs before that. So
yes. But if you looked at today's game and if you looked at, let's say, a Shreyas Iyer, they didn't look like they were even in the same universe as everybody else.
Let me ask you this. This is something which is going on Twitter quite often. I mean, people are comparing, let's say, the fitness level of Dhoni or people here for 20 hours and saying, remember how Sachin batted in Sharjah. Are we saying that it's inconceivable to me that people now are not as fit as Sachin was back then? So what has changed?
No, first of all, you have to understand that when Sachin was batting in Sharjah in a 50 overs game, you are not consistently being asked to hit sixes or fours every ball, right? And, you know, for those of you who have played cricket, you know that it just takes a lot out of you physically to hit a six, no matter how good you are. This is a, you know, it's like bowling, just like bowling at 140 miles per hour. It takes a lot out of you, not just in terms of the physicality of the stress that your shoulders take, but the fact is that your reflexes have to be on a razor's edge in order to time it. So this is essentially draining your, it's draining your energy, you know, that hyper state of being this hyper aware. Now, you don't need to be like this in a one-day game. There are places in which you can take it easy, you know, just move the strike around. So it doesn't really take that much out of you, I would say, than for instance, the situation that Karthik, for instance, came out to bat today, where he was basically asked to hit a six, you know, every ball. And, you know, look at somebody like Rahul Tripathi. I mean, Rahul Tripathi is not a first-class talent in terms of, nobody would say Rahul Tripathi is the future of Indian cricket. But Rahul Tripathi at one point of time was, you know, ridiculously easy. He was like taking, he was ridiculously, you know, the way he was playing, you would think that Dhoni would be able to play like that. And Dhoni is obviously a much better batsman than Rahul Tripathi was, without saying, but he just couldn't. It's not that Rahul Tripathi is better than him. Rahul Tripathi is like orders of magnitude worse than Dhoni, I would say. Even quite a bit worse than Karthik too. But it's just that he's young. He can play like that. He's in the zone. Maybe 2 years later, he will, of course, age much faster than you know, great talent. Because one of the things that I remember, it was written about Sunil Gavaskar at one point of time, was that once Sunil Gavaskar lost his hand-eye coordination, for years, he basically played on muscle memory. Just the muscle memory. It's not that he could see that well, or it was just that, you know, the instinct that he had. Obviously, this comes from being a high-caliber sports person. And obviously, this is what separates Dhoni. But, you know, Dhoni has reached... Dhoni and, again, everybody in his generation. I think that Harbhajan deciding not to take this tour was perhaps an extremely... you know, it's a good decision, I would say. I think he realized that once the tournament moves to UAE, he just would not be able to perform in that extreme heat. That he was just physically, I believe, not up to it at this point of time. It's easier, much easier, even in India. I mean, those of you who have been in those parts, it's a very different kind of heat there than it's here. And yeah. I think it's taking a toll. I think that one of the things is that the COVID bubble, the heat, a lot of things. And
the lack of spectators probably too.
Yes, exactly. So one of the things that, you know, players who are kind of getting on, you know, they draw from the energy of the crowd, which as I said before, it's not there. So that too is not there. There's only that synthetic, you know, strange, eerie, synthetic applause, which comes out. And so I mean, all of these things factor in, and you can see this universally across all teams, that the veterans are doing really, really poorly. And I'm not even getting into, you know, Shane Watson territory at this point of time. Vijay, Shane Watson. I mean, they're just not showing up match in and match out. They just cannot. So this has been fairly interesting. Of course, KKR is very disappointing today to see them lose. And I think that one of the things that I now realize is that unlike other teams, KKR has a major problem at this point of time, which is that the captain is, and to an extent, this is true for Chennai Super Kings also. But the fact is, Chennai Super Kings just don't have an option at this point of time. Dhoni has to be the captain because they even have another wicketkeeper that can keep in his absence. So, but in case of KKR, KKR would be a much stronger side if they decided mid-season to just drop Dinesh Karthik and drop Narayan, none of whom are playing well, and replace and instead of Narayan have Tom Banton, who can keep wickets and is also a very aggressive player and is of course very young and has been doing very, very well. So if you have somebody like Tom Banton and if you have somebody like Ewan Morgan, who's not being the captain, when Ewan Morgan has been one of the most transformational captains in modern times. When you look at what England was when he took over and where he took England to, you realize that Ewan Morgan isn't just a normal captain. He's somebody who's a cut above. And you have that guy in your team and you don't let him do what he's the best at, which is be cap. And it's obvious that, first of all, Dinesh Karthik is never really a great tactician. I think that has been proven over the last few IPLs. Now, as long as his performance justifies his place in the team, I'm always okay with, you know, somebody who's maybe not a good, great captain, but as long as he performs, at least he's setting up some kind of standards by his performance. So it's okay in a way. But the way he's playing, he's obviously the weakest link in that batting lineup at this point of time. And he didn't even look like the ways he has managed to get himself out. It's exactly like Uthappa. I mean, these are not the same players we have seen like 2 or 3 years ago in terms of, I mean, Robbie was a brilliant T20 player when he was in his prime. And it's almost sad to see him not just not being able to time the ball. I mean, the shots are there. It's the exact same shots. It's the exact same person. Robbie's, I think, even lost a little bit of weight also, but, you know, trying to get fit. But it's just not there. I mean, his timing consistently across games on fairly decent batting tracks, it's just off. It's not there. It's the same with Dhoni. You know, he doesn't seem to be confident also in many cases of doing this. So it's interesting. I really like the games this year. And I hope to see the high quality. And I think the reason is because of the pitches. And I'm pretty sure that at the end of the tournament, the highest run scorer will be KL Rahul. I think this will be...
Before you move on from IPL though, quick thing. As a SRH supporter, wanted to know who you have in your fantasy from SRH for today. Who you plan on having?
So the thing with SRH is that as you know, I put in a lot of thought behind my fantasy selections, and
There's a whole game theory going on there.
Yes, given the amount of thought I put into my fantasy selections, the return on investment is terrible. And this is why Bengalis should not do business. But I do put in a lot of thought and analytics into... So, for instance, today I had a majorly great day in my fantasy. And let me tell you why. Because I play on Krieg Battle and I play on the main like fantasy. I don't know, where do you play fantasy, Vikram?
So
today what happened was they had two games together. So you had to pick your game team for two games together, which means you can't change in the middle. So today I knew that Virat Kohli was going to do well, but I just didn't have the points to take him. I just didn't. And then I could have adjusted my team to take Virat Kohli. But then I realized by looking at the concept that the chances that somebody is going to pick up points at Sharjah is way more than somebody who's picking points at Abu Dhabi. So I loaded my team today, absolutely loaded my team with everybody who was playing the Sharjah match, which is exactly what I'm going to do tomorrow also. So I'm going to go over my budget of people just because it's Sharjah. Because in Sharjah, the thing is that usually not more than three or four, I mean, in general, it happened to Kolkata, not more than three or four people are going to get a chance to bat. But given the fact that, you know, sports are going to go in the 220, it's very likely that somebody in the top three is going to get a century or going to come close. Like today, Shreyas Iyer came close. So my captain today, my power player was Shreyas Iyer for the two games. And my vice captain was, of course, Andre Russell. Of course, he screwed up, but Andre Russell at least bowled well, so he got quite a few points there. I changed it at the end to Andre Russell. Before that, my vice captain was Prithvi Shah. So I it kind of went the way I knew that it was going to go today. So tomorrow, I don't know. Tomorrow, I think that tomorrow my fantasy picks is I'm the only person I regularly can keep in my side is obviously a David Warner.
Right, yeah.
I keep David Warner and I keep Natarajan because Natarajan is very cheap. And Natarajan, so any fantasy side, you need to take three bowlers. And the problem with this tournament as of now is that the bowlers are getting, you know, are getting hit. Especially if you are playing in Sharjah, bowler ka to gaya, total. So all you can do, but you have to take three bowlers. So all you can do is cut your losses and take the cheapest bowlers who are most likely to play. So you want to take the more expensive batsmen. So that's why I have three of the cheapest bowlers in my... So I have Rahul Chahar, who's always there because he's very cheap and he also gets wickets. That makes him doubly convenient. The left-handed... Seema from SRH.
Natarajan.
Natarajan. And so tomorrow, I think tomorrow, I would have liked to take David Warner and Bairstow, because I think one of them is going to score a century tomorrow.
Right.
Unfortunately, I will not be able to take Bairstow because it's two games together. So I need to make sure that the other game is represented. So either I had to go with... Then it's too risky to go into a two-gamer without Rahul in your side. Because no matter where he's playing. So either I had to take Bairstow or I had to take Rahul. So, you know, of course, it's Bairstow in Sharjah versus Rahul somewhere else. So I decided, okay, I'll take Rahul. So, but since it's tomorrow, I'm going with the top, you know. So tomorrow my punt is going to be on Bombay, Mumbai. And also Mumbai have another game coming up very soon. So that's why flood my side with Mumbai players as much as I can. Of course, the top three only. Because one of the things about Sharjah is it's not usually, even if the fourth guy comes in, he will come in at the 15th over. Even if he plays a blinder, he's not going to get a century. Like what happened to Ian Morgan, for instance. So you should always try to get people who bat in within the top three or four. All right. Enough of my fantasy tips. Moving on to Trump getting COVID. So when this whole thing started on March 16th, I had posted something on Facebook and I had even taken a screenshot and had tweeted it. It was about this story written by Edgar Allan Poe, called The Mask of Red Death. So in The Mask of Red Death, the story is that Prince Prospero, who, and this is set during the plague in Europe, which was of course very similar to COVID in terms of, you know, how destructive it was. So what Prince Prospero decides to do is he decides to take all his nobles and all the Lutyens crowd, as Arnav Goswami would say, and he starts a great party with them. He locks all the doors outside, so everybody is quarantined inside. It's stacked with food and all supplies they could need to last out for years. And he closes all connections with the outside world, and they start having a great, great, great party. You know, days and nights of parties. And the story is that, so the thing is that they want to isolate themselves from the disease. And while death rages outside and people are dying, that nothing comes in. It's a state of happiness inside. And then suddenly somebody perceives a stranger in the room. And this is a masked ball going on. So everybody's wearing masks. So that's The Mask of Red Death, spelled as M-A-S-Q-U-E. And those of you who haven't read the it's a short story, I strongly recommend you read it for just the strength of writing. And so this strange stranger comes in with a strange mask. And it's obvious that he does not belong to that group, which is strange because nobody from outside can come in. So where did that guy come in from? And this person kind of, the prince basically follows this person from room to room. And in the color of, each room is colored differently. And if you read it carefully, and if you know, each of those colors basically symbolize a different state of being afflicted with plague. And so the last room is black, which is death. So once he goes there, this masked intruder, you know, he turns around and he doesn't speak. And all the nobles, they kind of rush him to, you know, take tear off his mask to see who this person is. And one by one, they all die essentially, because in that guy, that mask is this death. And, you know, he is entered because you can't keep death out. You can't keep disease out. And the moral of the story is that when terrible things happen, you can't shut yourself out from them. It will find a way in. And with Trump, who's kind of been like Prince Prospero, living in a la-la land where he's been happy because he's always known that this thing can't happen to him. And on a personal basis, since Trump's entire perception of the world is through the lens of his own interests, is that COVID can never touch him. That since he lives in the most secure environment in the world, the most secure bubble, where, you know, everybody who gets in the room with Trump is tested for COVID. And that's been the case even when tests were not available for normal people. Even when people were just not being tested, there was always a profusion of tests for people who were around Trump so that Donald Trump does not get COVID. And guess what? He got COVID. So it just goes to show that two things that she goes to show. First of all, it goes to show that you just can't keep disease out. I mean, when something is as powerful as COVID, even the most powerful man in the world with the most secure protocols, which, mind you, he doesn't execute those protocols, competent people do. So he's at the center of this. And if there's one thing about about Trump, is he's a germaphobe. So he's not a kind of guy who goes and like has physical contact with people, unless of course he doesn't have consensual contact with people. For those of you who know Trump's rather checkered history. So Trump will not, Trump is extremely concerned about this himself personally. And yet it doesn't protect him. It doesn't protect him. It doesn't protect his wife. It didn't protect Herman Cain. It didn't protect Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, ex-governor of New Jersey. So this just goes to show that what a dangerous disease COVID is. And it's kind of, and this is worth remembering, because we're kind of at a stage where we are we culturally and psychologically have learned to live with COVID at this point of time. It's no longer something which is shocking, which unfortunately is leading people to once again drop the ball, because we've kind of made our deal with it. That, okay, I mean, we've got to carry on with our lives, and COVID is there, and COVID is going to kill certain, but it's not going to kill me. I mean, if it would have killed me, it would have killed me already. I mean, it's been almost like 6 months, and you know, I'm okay. So maybe it's not there. Maybe it's not out there. Of course it is. And as you can see, it doesn't matter what kind of precautions you take. Of course, that doesn't mean you shouldn't take precautions. But what I'm trying to say is that even if you have people who live in the most secure bubble that can be constructed, it will come in. Now, I don't know if things would have been better if Trump had worn a mask. I mean, the main purpose of a mask isn't really to protect yourself from the disease, but others from you. But it's also said that masks do decrease somewhat the risk of contacting it. That is also true, but it doesn't protect you. It decreases the risk. If Trump had worn it, I saw this picture of all the people who had been assembled in the super spreader event at which essentially Trump caught COVID. And for all the people there, one person actually was wearing a mask. And he got COVID too. Nobody else was wearing a mask. So, you know, you could say, well, they got COVID. This guy was wearing a mask and he got COVID too. So maybe he could have been wearing a mask just for that picture. He could have taken it off, or he could have just kept it below his nose. He could have been wearing it in the wrong way, of course. That might be the case.
Right.
So that's one thing, you know, it's terrifying for me. This thing, you know, Trump catching COVID, it just goes to show nobody's safe. The second thing that I want to talk about was the presidential debate, which was extremely controversial in the US, because people said it was one of the worst things that has ever happened in US history. And of course, this kind of, you know, hand-wringing and this o tempora o mores thing is highly amusing for me, because for me, I think the debate was very much fun. I mean, the complaint about the debate was that Trump was exceptionally badly behaved, that he frequently interrupted Joe Biden. And for us, for Indians who see Arnab Goswami, of course, this is not shocking at all. But the thing is that in a presidential debate, apparently it's supposed to be like a debate of ideas. They're supposed to present what their plans are, and they're supposed to compare and contrast with their policies and not get personal. But seriously, have the last 4 years not taught people anything about what the reality is? And if the complaint against Trump is that he was not being civil, let's just be honest here. Civility went out the door when on Jimmy Kimmel Live, you had a display being brought out of different kind of mushrooms, each of them representing a type of penis. And Stormy Daniels asked to say which of them resembled Trump's dick. Okay. So once you get to that level, once that, then this is not something on the internet or something. No, this is nighttime television on one of the major non-cable channels. If this is the level, and of course people found it hilarious at that point of time. But once you reach this level, you have to understand that there will be consequences for this. And this is something which I love to tell our quote-unquote liberal friends, that if you decide at some point of time that based on your delineation of the world of punching up and punching down, so some people you can do it, but some people you can't, you have to understand that once you set the standard, once you extend that so-called Overton window, it's going to come back. People are not going to buy your punching up, punching down thing. They're going to strike back using the exact same coin that you paid them in. And then they're going to justify by saying, well, that's you started it. And this has happened time after time. Much of India's fundamentalism was started, I would say, from Shah Bano and from the banning of Salman Rushdie's satanic verses, which at that point of time, because it was punching down, it was considered to be perfectly okay, that we couldn't say anything. But that precisely It just doesn't work like that. Reality does not work like that. So if you, as CNN was doing, you know, they were saying it was a dumpster fire, it was a shit show. Well, what is CNN actually, other than a dumpster fire and a shit show all rolled into one? Because CNN realized, as I said in a previous podcast, that over the last few years, CNN was a very boring channel. You know, over the last 2 years, they've undergone a total rejig of the way they present themselves. So they will use words like shit show and dumpster fire. You know, 2 years before, they wouldn't use these words at all. They'd be very, very staid and middle of the line and using, like, you know, news release kind of English to describe things. And obviously nobody watched them unless they were forced to watch it in an airport. But now CNN has viewership. It's kind of, you know, equally significant and sometimes even getting better than MSNBC because they have the better, the more dramatic anchors at this point of time. So CNN can't complain about the lack of civility when they have hardly been civil. And of course, Trump is not civil. And Trump understands that the reason why people tune into debates is not that anybody who hasn't made up their mind whether to vote. I mean, the concept of an independent, 40 days before an election itself is hilarious. That over the last 4 years, there was nothing that changed your mind either way to vote for one of these candidates or the other. That something is going to happen in the last 40 days. That was, aha, this is my aha moment. So there are no independents. People have made up their minds either way. And people who haven't made up their minds actually have made up their minds. They're just not saying it. So what is a debate for? A debate isn't, and especially in these days of polarization, no debate actually exists as a way of convincing the other person of the merits of your argument. I mean, nobody gives a flying fuck, really, what your argument is. You're evil. That's it. You're a fascist. You're a racist. You're a sexist, you're a misogynist, you're a misandrist, you're a something. You belong to some kind of hated group. And so whatever you say, whatever, if your words, if your lips move, you're lying. So given that presumption that's common to any kind of public discourse, whether it be in social media or whether it be in a presidential debate, what is the moral standard? What is the moral, ethical debate standard that we are supposed to maintain? None. And Trump understood that. I mean, he basically went out and he made it into a nasty spectacle, which is precisely what his base wants him to do. The reason why you have these debates isn't to win over moderate voters to your cause. If you haven't won them over already, a debate performance isn't going to help you. The purpose of a debate is to rile up your base. See, this is like when you are preparing for an examination. Like you're preparing for your board examinations and there are 2 days left for the examinations. Now, what do? There are certain chapters which you have decided that you won't study. If they come and you don't know, that's it. That's a risk you're willing to take. You hope there will be some alternatives and you'll be able to do them and they'll be part of what you have studied. So what do you do in the last 2 days? Do you start then studying the things which you have never studied for the last few years? No, you don't. You go back to your strengths and you try to make them, you try to optimize that. You try to make sure that at least that, if you get it, you'll hit it. That's really what you do at the end of an exam. And that's exactly what Trump is doing. His main objective at this point of time is to make sure that his base shows up to the elections. That's the main thing. So what he has to do is he has to do something which is like throwing red meat to his base. This is not a question of policies. I mean, who cares for policy? People don't care for policies and they never vote in an election because of policy. They vote because of emotion. And that's true for US elections, that's true for Indian elections, and that was a criticism that Plato had about democracy thousands of years ago. That, you know, all this policing and all these speeches, they're all useless. Ultimately, people vote based on their basest instincts, which is mostly hatred of somebody else. That's really what people vote for. They don't even vote for a positive reason. And that's really what Plato said, and he's like 100% right, 100% correct. So, I liked the debate. I felt it was amazing. And I felt that Trump did what he was supposed to do. and all this mock outrage that has resulted from it would have happened no matter what Trump had done. Because they hate Trump, so whatever Trump said is going to be terrible. And of course, Trump deserves to be hated. I hate him too. So it's not a question that I'm supporting Trump. But what I'm saying is that I'm a Trump supporter. That's definitely not the case. But the fact is, there was nothing that Trump did that in that debate that has not been done to him far worse. And that it's too late at this point of time, a month before the elections, to talk about civility in public discourse or to talk about things being or talk about presidential. I mean, Trump hasn't been presidential, but the media hasn't given him the reverence that presidents get otherwise also. I mean, I don't think that for any other president, we would have a discussion about how their dick looks. I don't think anybody, even George W. Bush was hated.
Similarly, nobody. Don't you think that even his wife has been kind of pulled into unnecessary jokes? Generally, the first lady is kept off in all political discussions, but I don't see that happening.
Usually is, and again, the one of the things that you know they say repeatedly is that Trump wants to have sex with his daughter. That's not true, actually. If you just try to understand what Trump is trying to say, for Trump, anything. So the problem with Trump isn't that Trump wants to have sex with his daughter, which all of these people will repeatedly say, because he always says, look, she's so hot, I would have dated her if she wasn't my daughter. See, the problem with Trump is that, and this is his unique mental buildup, is that he's unable to look at any kind of woman to have any worth other than hotness. That is the only one criteria that he judges women on, which is how hot are they, how hot or not.
It's the only metric he knows.
It's the only metric. For him, women do not exist as human beings. There's no two ways about it. And this is not, I'm not saying this based on one. So the problem really is something else. It's not that he wants to have, you know, boing his daughter, as people, as comedians here want to say. It's that he is so, so, so misogynist. I mean, so much so. That he's unable, even for his own daughter, he's unable to look beyond that one single characteristic that he feels defines women. And so what he's trying to say is, what other normal people would say is, look how amazing my daughter is. You know, look how smart she is. You know, and again, with Trump, it's all about himself. So he's like, look how well I brought up my daughter. Look at how great my genetic material is. Look at how, you know, great my daughter is, except he can't say the word great associated with a woman unless it's the word hot. That's the only thing he can think of. And so, again, this is not in support of Trump, but this is also not true. What he says is also, and CNN, all these guys and all these are smart enough to realize that. What I'm saying is fairly evident. But they will not call that out. They will go for the cheap shot. And then they ask, and then they become, and then they suddenly take the high road and say, oh my goodness, all norms have been thrown out of the window. All norms have been thrown out of the window for the last 4 years. And some of it Trump has done, and some of it Trump's opponents have done. So at this point of time, you can't put the proverbial genie back into the bottle. Which brings me to the third topic for today, which is Hathras and Balrampur. So there are two distinct things that there are two distinct issues that are part of this. And unfortunately, again, in an extremely polarized world that we live in, some people will only focus on one of these issues, and some people will only focus on the other. Let's first focus on issue number one, which I would say is the minor issue. And I deliberately say this is the minor issue because I'll come to the major issue later. The minor issue is, it's minor because, first of all, it's well known. And secondly is, I'll come to it. Let me explain it. So there's an article, and I'll post it in the show notes, written by CNN about the rapes in Hathras and Balrampur. So I'll quote. Both women from the northern state of Uttar Pradesh were Dalits, the lowest ranked in India's caste-based hierarchy, according to the All India Mahila Congress, the women's wing of India's main opposition party. So for the Balrampur, two men have been arrested for the alleged rape and murder. Note, nothing about the religion is said. Now, two paragraphs later, same article. Four men have been arrested and booked for rape and murder in the 19-year-old's case, according to police in the Hathras district. All four were from an upper caste community and have also been booked for crimes against minorities, according to the statement. Now, for those of you who know that in Balrampur, the suspects are Muslims. And in Hathras, the suspects are Hindus. Now, CNN, and this is not, the reason why I'm picking out CNN is because they have made this, they have done this in the space of one article itself. There are other people on Twitter who have at least spread their hypocrisy out between two tweets. Is that the focus right now, I mean, in one case, it is definitely a caste thing. And I will agree, it is. That is not wrong. However, why isn't it a religious thing in the other case? Now, if CNN's idea was that they have decided beforehand that, okay, in the case of Balrampur, there is no religion involved. It's just a crime. It's a crime of a man on a, it's crime of men on a woman. But in Hathras, it is not just a crime of men on a woman, but it is a crime of men on women based on caste. Well, if this is the stance that they were going with, whether it's true or not is another thing, then why in the first case did you once again mention the fact that the victim was from a lower caste? Then you shouldn't have mentioned that either in the first case. Then you should have just kept it as something between a crime between individuals. But no, you do mention it and you don't mention the religion of the perpetrator so that anybody who reads it would think that the last paragraph actually applies to the first crime also. That's the sleight of hand of this, which is going on over here. Again, this is something which the media, especially the foreign media, does. And we have our people in India, Indian reporters and Indian media people who for $1,000 article will definitely do this because this is what allows them to get the next $1,000 article. So that's why they do it. But again, I would say this is not a big deal. This is not a big deal in the context of the second issue, which is the much bigger deal. So why does this happen? We've discussed this before. It's the whole punching up, punching down thing. You know, the best example of this was between Camus and Sartre, the French philosophers, when Sartre found out that the Russian state, and they were both communists, that the Russian state were running slave labor camps. Sartre said, we should never tell people. And Camus said that he wanted to cover this in his magazine, that the Russians were running slave labor camps. And Sartre said famously that, no, we should not cover this. We should hide this fact from other people. Because if this gets known, then people will use this as a way to justify their prejudice against communists. So this is exactly the logic that goes on here. That let's not mention the religion if it's not Hindu, because then this will be used as a, you know, as a weapon against minorities who have done this. So this is really what's going on through their mind. But again, as I say, this does not work. And when you start doing this, and this is not, the CNN isn't the only place that has done it, you essentially allow, and there are people who want to cover up what happened in Hathras. You give them a weapon and say, well, what about this? I mean, that's happening in Uttar Pradesh. Why aren't you talking about this? Why are you hiding the religion and why are you hiding that part of this crime? And that's a valid point to make. But it is also not, and this is an important thing, it is also not a valid point to make in order to hide what is the bigger problem, which is caste-based vile atrocities on women in the state of Uttar Pradesh. And it happens in a state of Rajasthan. So this is not a uniquely BJP problem. And again, with Rajasthan and Uttar Pradesh, it's not just that it's not like Trinamool Congress, which rules for 20, 30 years, or CPM. These governments change. So this is not so much a problem of the government that's ruling, whether it be Congress or Samajwadi Party, or it is a problem of the general law enforcement infrastructure and the entrenched casteism that exists in many states of India that many people in urban India like to pretend that doesn't exist, mainly because it is not part of our urban existence to the extent that it is in the backwaters of India. So this is the important thing. It's not, there are other side issues which are taking away from discussing, and they're taking away because there are some people who want that to happen. They want the focus to be on India Today, you know, dressing up protests for TRPs and coaching the victims' families. This is exactly the angle that Arnab Goswami decided to run with, rather than the main issue. Of course, any channel that has Sardesai in it, I mean, what standards do you expect from them? But that, again, is a minor point. It is a minor point in front of the bigger problem, which is caste-based violence on women. And if you've read, you know, articles, if you've looked at, there's a lot of good reportage online with people going and talking to the victims. What is inexcusable is the Uttar Pradesh government disposing of the cops in a way that does not allow for, I mean, it's very obvious why it was done, so that the cases are less likely to stand in court. And for the recorded video of the, I guess, the IS officer going there and saying, you know, the media will leave, we will be here, so, you know, let's not talk about this, we'll all settle this among ourselves. So these things are the matter of concern. It's not so much media bias, or it's not what CNN is saying. These are minor things. And in a way, what are you going to do about it? Nothing really. As long as you don't have another ecosystem, these people will keep on doing what they do. But again, that's not the main point. The point is, what are we going to do for this, which persists in 2020? So if you look at the videos, if you read about your ground journalists, the Valmiki say that, you know, for centuries, they have not been integrated with the community, that they stay in a state of perpetual fear that of Thakurs there. And that whatever peace there is kind of a peace that exists because, you know, one group of people just, you know, keep their eyes down and their heads down all the time. And that's tragic. That's the bigger issue here. And the fact that, you know, many people just refuse to recognize this for what it is, which is caste violence, because for them, they've brought into the lie that caste doesn't exist anymore because they haven't experienced caste. And that is the bigger story here. It's not the big story that the UP government engaged a PR agency. I think that's perfectly fine in this day and age, given that the other side also has PR agencies working for them, that they have a very well-oiled PR agency against them. So it's fine to engage a PR agency. What is not fine is the attempt to cover up the crime. It's an attempt to burn the dead body without their parents' consent at night. That is a terrible thing. I mean, that, again, this, anybody who knows anything about UP would know that, yeah, well, this is par for the course for Uttar Pradesh. This is the way things work in Uttar Pradesh. This is the cynicism that comes on. And of course, this is Uttar Pradesh. But that shouldn't be the case. That's where the real outrage should be. And of course, we have to take a look back and see that ultimately it doesn't matter. It's a issue of women's safety. The real victims here are obviously women. It doesn't matter whether the perpetrators, you know, whether ultimately it doesn't really matter. It's just the fact that the reason why these things happen is simply because that for every one that we hear of, there are hundreds that we don't. I mean, that is the real tragedy. That when you hear, you know, we think, okay, well, four men have been arrested and booked. I mean, ultimately, there's something's going to happen to them. They're not going to get away, given the political pressure that's going on. They're not going to get away because they just got caught this time, and it just happened to be that their stars were not aligned. For every four men that we hear has been arrested, booked for rape and murder, and it's absolutely, you can be 100% positive that there are many, many more who have gotten away. It's not that everybody who does it immediately gets caught and get arrested, booked, and then get the death penalty. If that was the case, then trust me, nobody would be doing it, which is why nobody goes to rob banks.
Yeah, I think the statistic I remember is that 7% is the closure rate for crimes on women.
It's not a question of closure rate. If it's not even recognized, The fact is, when most rape victims go to the thana, they refuse to take their complaint because they don't want it to count within their statistics. That's why.
So it'll be way below even 7% because most
of them are. Yes, they'll just not accept it. That's the thing. Every person, this comes across all states that police just refuse to take your complaint, and the police will, rather than taking your side, will take the side of the perpetrator. They will be the other side's advocate, and the principal reason for that is they don't want to do the work. Once it gets into their metric system, then they have to follow up, they have to write a report, they have to go and report. So one thing is just, and especially if somebody is of a lower caste, especially if somebody doesn't know their rights, it's so much easier just to say, you know what, this was something, we're not even taking your complaint at this point of time. So nothing, the data is absolutely fucked. I mean, whatever we think is the data, and we talk about closure rates, and we talk, none of this, these are grossly, grossly underreported. So that is the main scandal here. That is the main scandal that, you know, it's not the crime is a scandal. This is that will remain, but it is the attitude of the authorities, irrespective of political party. But this is a culture which, of course, varies from state to state. In some states, it's worse than it is in other places. In Uttar Pradesh, is one of the worst in terms of caste distinctions, in terms of how entrenched caste is in the law enforcement machinery, in every sense of the term. And it is, and that to me is the biggest thing. And when I see people on Facebook writing that, you know, why are we talking about caste? It's just a crime of is this a crime and we should treat it as, it's not. It's not. I mean, I am one of the people who always say that we should look at things as crimes and not try to use, you know, group struggle to interpret everything. And that's true. The Marxist approach is to take any kind of thing and interpret it as a struggle between punched down groups and punched up groups. But it's not that it's never true. I mean, in this case, it is definitely true that the caste angle is there. I mean, it is the main thing. The fact that these four Thakur men thought that they could get away with impunity, and they would have gotten away with it with impunity had it not been for the video, had it not been for some of the political aspects who want to raise these things. It's because that people are looking for, the media is looking for things in Uttar Pradesh. If this was happening in a state, let's say, which was not ruled by the BJP, they perhaps wouldn't be looking for it. So that's there too. But that doesn't mean that the crime isn't violent. That doesn't mean that the crime isn't terrible. It's just that it happens to be that at this point of time, any case which happens in Uttar Pradesh is bound to get some amount. And I would even say, while saying that there are hundreds of crimes in Uttar Pradesh which don't get covered, I'm absolutely sure. It's not that, as I said, it's not that the reason why these four men could go and do this is because in their mind, they have been brought up in a place where, in a culture where they know inherently without anybody telling them that the odds of them getting away with it are overwhelmingly in their favor. It's not somebody gave them, it's not a consultant came and showed them mathematical models of prediction and said, you know what, based on this modeling, you're going to get away with this. This, no. They know, as being part of that system and being born into that milieu, that really there is very little chance that anything terrible will happen to them. It's like in India, if you jump a red light or if you drive the other way down a one-way road, what's going to happen to you? Not nothing much. Maybe in a metro it might go to a district town, who cares? This is exactly the kind of thought process that goes into these people's heads. And again, very soon the death penalty will be brought up. And I am absolutely in favor of death penalty in these cases, because one of the only ways, especially when the law doesn't work in the way it's supposed to, is that even when, so risk is a function of likelihood and severity. So since we cannot as a society, unfortunately, reduce the likelihood, we should definitely try to increase the severity. So the cost of being caught should be very, very, very high. It should not be that, okay, you get to live your life in jail, at least for the rest of your life or for 10 years when you're bailed out. In any case, how bad is life in jail on somebody else's dime? Then, you know, living in a village is not a big deal. No, the cost should be really, really high. So that's why I support the death penalty. Ultimately, we need to work as a society on the likelihood part of it. But this is a tall ask in a place like Uttar Pradesh, given the culture that's entrenched of deep misogyny. Again, the word misogyny, unfortunately, sometimes in our internet buzzfeed world is used very loosely. It's used very loosely. You know, if somebody doesn't like what you're saying and you happen to be a man, you can always say, you know, you're a misogynist. I'm not talking about this. This is really misogyny. I mean, there's no doubt about it. This is misogyny. This is caste hatred. It's an intersection of these two. And nobody should try to deflect from the seriousness of this problem by bringing up India Today or by bringing up, hey, look at what CNN did. I mentioned that because it exists. We should talk about it because we shouldn't try to hide it, because if we try to hide it, then people will say, look, they're hiding it. No. But at the same time, we should make sure that we do not equate the two and do not think that by talking about the smaller problem, we can somehow not talk about the bigger problem. Because you see, the bigger problem doesn't exist, right? I mean, the bigger problem, so what, it happened. But have you looked at what India Today did? It doesn't matter, really. It doesn't matter what India Today did. Yes, sure, India Today, as I said, Rajdeep Sardesai, what do you expect? But of course, we have to expect more from the Uttar Pradesh government. We have to expect, in 2020, we have to as a country, forget nationalism, forget all those things, but if we as a country need to survive, we have to change a system in which a section of people live in mortal fear of other people just because of the way they're born. And if you look at the video coverage, it's very evident that there are Valmikis there who live in fear, who live in constant fear of what can happen to them. And this should not be happening in this day and age. And nothing that India Today does or nothing that CNN writes comes even close to the terrible tragedy that this is. And I strongly hope that in both these cases, the death penalty is applied because of the viciousness and the heinousness of the crimes in both cases. And I think we society need to consider the fact that the cost of these actions justice needs to be quick, and it needs to be unambiguous. And at least till we can have some, and it's not going to happen in a day, year, maybe even in a generation, but as long as we cannot reduce the likelihood, as long as we cannot change that mental model by which men think that they can get away by doing these things and that the odds are stacked in their favor, then we need to, perhaps we can't do anything about the likelihood odds, but we can definitely do something about the severity odds. That's really in our hand. And this is where I just don't understand the liberal problem with having more severe punishment. I mean, I understand that that they want to work more on the likelihood, and that's a perfectly good thing to do. But I'm just saying that, you know, in any risk management activity, when you want to have good outcomes, you have to work on both sides of the equation. And you have to look at what we can change immediately versus what we have to spend. I don't know. It's definitely not going to happen in my lifetime. I know that. Is to change this equation in Uttar Pradesh. And, you know, the last thing that I wanted to say is that at some point of time when I was younger, I always used to feel that, you know, naively that religion and caste should be kept out of politics. You know, that, you know, why should there be a Bahujan Samaj party, and why should there be? But there has to be. There has to be. Now that I am older, I realize that, yeah, it has to be. It's not that, it's like this. Ideally, in an ideal world, we should engage with politics on an individual level. And it's also true that not everything we do or our entire human experience isn't really a function of which group we belong to, which is really the starting point of what Marxism is. That's also not true. Actually, it's actually totally wrong. But it doesn't also mean that as a centrist that there isn't something in between where it is kind of true that in politics, which reflects our daily lives, it is needed that we should have a Bhim Army, that we should have a Mayawati, and we should have a Kasiram. We have to have that. We should also have an OAC because it's essential, because we definitely do have the other wing. We definitely do have, you know, hardline sections of the BJP. So in an ideal world, there should not be any caste-based politics. There shouldn't be any religion-based politics. But given that there is, well, every caste configuration, every religious configuration needs to have parties or individuals who are primarily motivated in making their constituents better. It's essential in a place like India. So this is, again, sometimes people ask this question, when what things have you evolved in? This is one of the things which have evolved in. At one point, I always felt totally uncomfortable by caste-based politics and by the Lalu Yadavs in the world. I mean, the Lalu Yadavs have different problems, but it's not the legitimacy that they should not represent, let's say, Yadavs, or they should not. Obviously, they have to. People have to represent. There needs to be representation. The right. only way that... I mean, look at what's happened in Hathras, just as an example. The fact is that the Valmikis there don't have anybody politically speaking for them also. And that is a problem.
And that way, I mean, the Indian political scene is more, if I can use the term, a free market, right? Wherever there is a vacuum, you have a political party coming in. Whereas in US, of course, you have just the two duopolies. So if I had to put
that because the US, it's... You're right. US politics is different, I would say. But in Indian politics, given the abject state that those on the lower spectrum of the class hierarchy face, they are in, and it's compounded by poverty. So it's both, you know, a deadly combination of generational poverty, lack of education, and the fundamental fact that they are not respected as human beings by virtue of their birth, that these three things coming together, there are no easy solutions for a very difficult problem. But the least that we should afford them is the right to have their own political representation that looks after exclusively their interests, especially when those interests are in conflict. Because in any democracy, things are in conflict. Not everybody can be happy. So there needs to be some party or something that represents them and acts as their advocate. And at that point of time, if your reaction is to call all of these people as anti-nationals, then that is also, well, for the want of a better word, not a good thing. Okay, so that's the podcast for today.
All right. So wrapping up, let me remind you again about how you can support Arnab directly. One is, of course, to pledge any amount that you're comfortable with on Patreon. And the other is to buy his books. If you notice, we have links to both in the show notes. So do take a moment out and to show your appreciation. So that's it for today. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.